Kreisky Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Very welcome to our third edition of the series Dialogues for Tomorrow in cooperation with Bruno Kreisky Forum and the Institute for Human Science, Die Angewandte. My name is Elisabeth Falkensteiner and I'm the co-director of Angewandte Interdisciplinary Lab, and I'm very happy and delighted to host the discussion between Philipp Blom and Oliver Stünkel. And I would also like to thank Gerhard Auer, the Secretary General of Bruno Kreisky Forum, and Michel Glenny, Director of the Institute of Human Science. And the stage is yours.
I just want to say it's a particular pleasure for me to be here this evening with Oliver and Philip, because I spent 2 or 3 years in Brazil. Brazil is a very special, interesting country in so many ways, but it's also really important for the rest of the world, not just because of the fact that it has the Amazon there, but also it has 200 million people, many of whom are extremely enterprising. It has resources the like of which most countries can only dream of. And it's much more important than most people really understand. So we're very pleased to have got Oliver, who is really one of the leading academics and minds of Brazil, to explain to us what Brazil thinks and how Brazil reacts with the rest of the world today. So Oliver, thank you very much for coming.
Good evening. I'm really thrilled to welcome you all here to this conversation. We want to have a series of conversations here about the future. This is called Dialogues for Tomorrow. We're all working very much with problems of the past and perhaps also of the present, but let us look ahead, and where better to look than to Latin America? And who better to talk to about that with Oliver de la Costa Stunkel, who is a professor for international relations in Sao Paulo, who is also with the Carnegie Endowment in New York, I think, Washington. Born in the exotic city of Düsseldorf, I believe. A German-Brazilian academic who has really made it his work to explore the relations within the post-Western world, and that's what I want to talk to him about today. Oliver, we are living in a time in which we continually hear the word polycrisis. Indeed, I've made a radio program about that today. And two of the most immediate events we can see in this crisis are the wars in Ukraine and also in Gaza. And what many people in Western countries noticed to their great surprise and dismay was that countries of what is usually called the Global South no longer seemed willing to play ball, especially, for instance, Brazil's President Lula has a very different attitude to Ukraine as the governments in Washington or in Europe would like. Tell me about this cleavage that is opening up between a Western world that appeared to be sure of its hegemony and a Global South that is beginning to find its own voice.
That's an easy question. No, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. I've had great conversations already over the past days here, and I think there's such a need to strengthen the dialogue between Latin America and Europe. So I think this is a fantastic opportunity to exchange ideas. And I think the fact that there is such a divergence of views, which have little to do with Ukraine or Gaza per se, but which are actually reflections of just a fundamental difference of how countries across the Global South interpret long-term historical trends, shows how important it is to establish platforms where more people can actually engage. And I think that one of the goals of my work is also to increase the presence of scholars from Latin America on many of the platforms and places where the agenda is being set on large conferences to discuss the future. So I think this is a fantastic opportunity. I think that the divergence between Brazil, which is particularly interesting because the West was essential to producing a hostile environment for Jair Bolsonaro, who's the former Brazilian president, and was actively rooting for the return of Lula. And particularly the United States was putting a lot of pressure on Brazil's military to assure that if Lula were to be victorious in last year's election, that they wouldn't step in to actually, and that they would allow him to take power. So there was a bit of a disappointment.
That pressure was also bore fruit when the attempt was made to overthrow the government.
Exactly. On January 8th this year, we had our version of January 6th in Washington, very much predictable. It's kind of a carbon copy of what had happened in the United States. And I think that there was some kind of expectation that somehow Brazil would be more aligned with the West on some of these key issues. But interestingly enough, there's not really any difference between Bolsonaro and Lula when it comes to Ukraine, for example. Israel is a bit of a different issue because it has become hugely polarized and integrated into the domestic polarization. But Ukraine is, I think, particularly important because there's a number of reasons for why Brazil is very reluctant to side with the West. The first is, I think that the reaction across the Global South in 1989 was completely different than the one you had in Europe, of course, which was one of celebration. But in Brazil, it was actually one of anxiety and apprehension of what would it mean to live close to a superpower now that there was no one left to constrain the United States. And that's not an anti-American sentiment. This is actually across the aisle, just a concern given the United States' very controversial history in Latin America, formal claim through the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century that the United States has, let's say, special responsibilities and rights across the Western Hemisphere, and where the last U.S. president actually explicitly said he believes that the Monroe Doctrine was still alive. So I think the notion, and you were referring to the polycrisis. In the West, I have a sense that the polycrisis is seen in the context of a shift towards multipolarity, which is seen to be dangerous. We're moving into the unknown because it's a post-Western world. And the countries which are gaining more power, they're, from a Western view, not entirely committed possibly to upholding the rules and norms. Whereas in Brazil, the transition to multipolarity is not only seen as inevitable, but actually as desirable. Partly because Brazil, I think, slightly overestimates its capacity to be a pole in that multipolar order. And it's actually also quite interesting that from an academic perspective, international relations theory suggests that multipolarity is not ideal for a country like Brazil, which is large and very vulnerable. It has very limited military capacity. But still, the shift towards a post-Western world in which the West is important but not decisive, it's just one of many actors, is across the aisle, across Latin America, seen as something positive because it will make life more difficult for the United States. And that's why under no circumstances would Brazil ever, for example, impose sanctions on on Russia, because that would make life difficult for one of the few countries that has the capacity to constrain the United States, which again is not an anti-American sentiment. Most people across Latin America have a very favorable view of the United States. Lots of them move to the United States. Nobody wants to emigrate to Russia. but it's still seen as a useful country. And I think that's the first key issue, that this transition is not seen as a move towards the unknown, but much rather perhaps even a move towards back to normal, because this period, short period of Western dominance, which isn't actually all that, it's not that many centuries, it's basically sort of early 19th century all the way to now, is also seen as a very unusual period in history and not the normal. And when you look at it, historically speaking, that's actually largely the correct interpretation, that Western leadership is a fairly short period of the last 1,000 years. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing, and I think that's relevant to us today, is that there is a perception across Latin America that the rules and norms are positive. So Brazil has benefited mightily from the multilateral rules-based order after World War II. It's been crucial because, and that's why Brazil is profoundly pro-UN, it's pro-international law, and it prides itself of being part of countries that were crucial for the establishment of international law, which is, by the way, not seen as a Western imposition. There is a profound belief that it was the anti-colonial movements which are responsible for things like self-determination, not Woodrow Wilson, it's sort of the Global South. But the perception that these rules and norms are not applied universally, and because the Western discourse is so universal, it of course makes itself profoundly vulnerable to the accusation of double standards.
And when the West invades Iraq in the name of freedom and democracy, that's okay. Yeah. If Russia does the same in Ukraine, it's somehow not okay.
Yeah, and what I'm going to say here is I don't necessarily support personally some of these views I'm describing here, but this was of course the key. And I remember in 2014 the G20 was in Australia, and the foreign minister of Australia in 2014 suggested that Russia be excluded from the G20. And of course the reaction across the Global South was, why did nobody talk about excluding the United States from the G8 at the time, which is now the G7, when the invasion happened? I know there's of course many differences, and the United States at no point sought to annex Iraq, but the comparison is being made. And I think the perception that Ukraine, that the West gave an exaggerated importance, which again is not something I necessarily agree with, was so dominant that Brazil was willing to allow the divergence from Western views to actually produce enormous friction in its relationship to the United States. The United States has not agreed to pay more than $50 million to help Brazil protect the Amazon, which is profoundly disappointing. Because and this is not a particularly Brazilian position. If you see, actually, there's only two presidents in Latin America who have embraced largely a Western position, which is Chile and Guatemala. So only two. All the rest is largely aligned when it comes to that, and that's also true across Africa and across parts of Asia.
Do you talk of these perceptions, which are, I think, surprisingly powerful factors in this? When you look at the changing conversation between the global north and the global south, there's post-colonial history in the room. There's also, of course, economic development, and there are, real politic ambitions and a look for political power. How important do you think are these aspects when it comes to that conversation?
I think realpolitik is real, and I think it's sort of easy for many developing countries to accuse the West, of course, of double standards, but there is something also slightly immoral of the idea of saying it's just in our geopolitical interest to not condemn Russia. even though there was something that in principle Latin American governments could actually relate to of Ukraine's plight, which is it's a small country next to a very large country. And the genuine concern about what that large country will do to you. And these things sometimes seem, it's hard to actually grasp how relevant this is, still is in Latin America's worldview. Sometimes, for example, I remember Macron at the height of the Amazon fires, he said, if Brazil can't solve this, then perhaps the international community should address the Amazon deforestation. And to Brazilian observers, this implicitly questions Brazil's sovereignty over the Amazon. And then the European and Western response is, oh, come on, I mean, all these like US interference in Chile to overthrow the Allende government, this is like so long in the past, so don't really, it's an exaggeration to be so concerned about sovereignty. But I think two things are forgotten. The current primaries of the Republican candidates, all of them largely agree with bombing Mexico to stop the drug cartels exporting drugs to the United States, which is a horrifying precedent for countries across the region. So there is this continued sense of threat, of course. So in that sense, I think there should be more understanding of Ukraine's plight, but also because thanks to the war, Brazil has now access to Russian oil, gas, and fertilizers at a massive discount. And this is true across the global south. And the Russians are actively underbidding the Canadian fertilizer companies, which have offered these fertilizers to Brazil. But Brazil is obviously happy to purchase fertilizer at a huge discount, which is so important to its agricultural, to its agricultural industry. I think the in addition to that, I think the view of sort of the Ukrainian narrative that this is an anti-colonial war doesn't function well in the global south, because the colonial experience from a global south perspective is so racialized that it doesn't sort of make sense in that sense. So I think this is not an approach that Ukraine has been able to utilize.
And that was very obvious when political leaders in the West started in the Gaza war to compare Israel with Ukraine.
Yeah.
And many people, especially in Latin America, said if this comparison works at all, then the Palestinians have to be Ukraine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that has been sort of the major comparison, and that has led scholars and policymakers across the global south to speak about double standards, and that has, I think, profoundly weakened the Western attempt to rally support for Ukraine in the developing world. I think that's true. Now, there's another issue which I think is just important, which is mutual ignorance. The global south has very limited ties to Ukraine.
You are trying to change that.
I'm planning to take a delegation of Latin American scholars to Kyiv next year, and I think this is, of course, just a tiny step of a much larger necessity to make Ukraine more relatable. And this is what I think has sometimes caused mutual disappointment, is that Brazil doesn't really have any particular disagreements with the West when you look at a Ukraine map and say, oh no, I actually think we disagree on what happened in Donbass. Because there's virtually no Ukraine scholarship across the global south. And it's quite interesting, I'm starting to map this. The people who have somehow been to Ukraine or study Ukraine are usually sort of the two or three people who have done their PhDs in Moscow in the 80s and are now in charge of this sort of Russian world in their anthropology departments or history departments or politics departments, and look at Ukraine from a Russian perspective, of course. So that's one thing. But it's also forgotten that Ukraine has not had ambassadors in all these places, and the ambassadors that are now coming to the global south speak no Portuguese, no Spanish, no of the many other languages, and they are encountering an environment in which the the lens through which countries like Brazil, but also South Africa or Chile, look at this war is that this is a proxy war between NATO and Russia. And Russia is the small guy. So this is not small Ukraine against big Russia. This is big NATO against a bit less big a Russia. So that's the first thing. And NATO just has an image problem across the global south. I mean, this is just as a fact, sort of. It's so I'm telling the Ukrainian ambassador to Brazil, don't mention NATO in this conflict, because from a global south perspective, Ukraine has no agency. They're being forced by NATO to fight this war. They actually perhaps don't even want that. So that's, I think, an interesting issue. And the second is, Russian diplomacy has, I think, is at times underestimated. The capacity of Russian diplomacy to relate to the global south is underestimated. And then the way Russian diplomacy engages the global south is, weirdly enough, far more sophisticated at times and less sort of paternalistic, let me tell you how to address these things, but actually kind of seeing we're both dealing with this, the West, which tells us how to do things, we're kind of on the same side. And of course, there's a vast amount of Russian propaganda, which falls on highly fertile ground in Latin America, where there's a anti-American predisposition. So somebody is willing to listen to you, which is, let's say, it's much more difficult for the United States to make their case vis-a-vis Ukraine than for Russia.
Not surprising with all that fertilizer, but yes. Tell me a little about, from a European, from a Western perspective, it almost looks like Southern America is now a continent taking its place on the world stage, wanting to assert its power, working very differently from how it did. But of course, it's not just Brazil. We've just had an election in Argentina that was very interesting, to say the least, an anarcho-capitalist at the head of a state. Colombia is just come out of a very bloody civil war and is looking for a new role for itself in Southern America and in the world. So how are these powers shaping up, or what is tripping them up? What is holding them back?
Yeah, so first of all, I think there's so much that could be done between Europe, Latin America ties. We're just now at the cusp of a profound transformation that will either involve the ratification of the EU-Mercosur trade deal, which would be the largest trade deal in the history of both the European Union and Mercosur. And if it goes through, it's a transformative event. It would modernize the relationship. It would be a huge step to make Brazil, I think, more competitive, integrate the country into global value chains. Also Argentina, it would be a huge victory, I think, for all those who are trying to overcome decades and decades of a sort of more protective economic policies, which I think have led to continuous disappointment. But the non-ratification, it's like a couple that for years and years talks about, should we get married or not? And then after years and years, they decide not to get married. And that's usually a very, you know, that is sort of a pre-breakup situation. And I'm really concerned of what the new narrative will be between Europe and South America if that deal doesn't go through. And of course, the election of Javier Milei, who is kind of a Trumpist, candidate who's a climate denialist, will be a fantastic news for European protectionists who will use the climate denialism to say, well, we can't really do a trade deal with this guy who thinks that climate change is a socialist hoax. But on, let's say, I would say across the global south, Latin America is by far Europe's best bet. And I always like to say, Brazil may be the West's weakest link, but it's also the BRICS' weakest link. And Brazil has been essential over years to moderate the anti-Western language Russia has sought to integrate into BRICS declarations.
Talk to me about BRICS quickly, because this is such a new thing for many people, and it is such a surprising alliance of states. And it's become quite an important alliance quite suddenly.
So I think the BRICS alliance has emerged due to the frustration and the perception that the established institutions that govern our world, like the World Bank and the IMF and the UN, have failed to fully adapt to new economic realities, and that it was time to establish new institutions, which I think was above all a good thing. And I've been part of, you know, BRICS discussions for a long time, and it was time for a country like Brazil, which was profoundly Western-centric. It was also anti-Western, but it was just anti-Westernism, I think, is also a problem because it's too Western-centric. The West is not that relevant. You know, it's just one actor, but there's many other actors you need to analyze to understand the world. So being excessively anti-Western is, you know, makes you too focused on one particular actor. So I think engaging Russia, engaging India, engaging China, which very quickly became the most important trading partner of Brazil and most Latin American and African countries, was crucial to adapt to that post-Western world, because we still don't really have a single leading sinologist in Brazil. So the discussion about China in Latin America, I mean, who discusses China? People, I'm simplifying a bit, but who get their tickets, which are extraordinarily expensive because you need to fly 24 hours, paid by the Chinese government to speak to Chinese policymakers. But they obviously have some limitations as they assess what the rise of China means. So complete information asymmetry. China understands the Global South much better than the Global South understands China. And I think just a means to engage policymakers, bureaucrats, scholars, with other countries from the BRICS where ties were quite incipient. So I think that was quite useful, and also to occasionally look at ways in which they could coordinate their positions when negotiating, for example, IMF reform. And I think that now it's transitioning towards something much more China-centric. So Brazil, for the first time, got a sense that prior to this BRICS meeting, which took place in South Africa just recently, that China kind of steamrolled through and imposed expansion, because now the BRICS grouping is being transformed into a more China-centric, an element of a more China-centric world, along with other institutions like the BRICS Bank, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
The head of the BRICS Bank is, I think, Dilma Rousseff.
That's right, the former Brazilian president, who Lula needed some place to get her out because she's so unpopular in Brazil, but still too important to just ignore. So you
send her to keep her busy
to the other side of the world, exactly, where you know she doesn't make much trouble. But yes, it's so these are kind of, this was seen as a sign of the necessity to produce new institutions to adapt to a post-Western world. And the BRICS are much, much more important than meets the eye in the Western media, where it's either demonized or belittled. But it's not really capable of articulating an anti-Western position, because a lot of these countries don't want to be anti-Western. But it's also not a joke. There are actually, on a yearly basis, more than 100 meetings between ministers of defense, ministers of education, ministers of the economy, national security advisors, think tanks, etc., to establish these ties, which, from a Brazilian perspective, have been quite useful. But I wanted to just mention one thing about sort of what's the Latin American view on things. And I think it's important to remember that even though Latin America was crucial to consolidate international law, so Latin American countries have been essential throughout the late part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century to fight for universal international law, without sort of gradations of, you know, Western countries and countries across the Global South. But the perception is also that Latin American countries were at the hard end of liberal order, and that the European understanding of liberal order is shaped by the fact that they got a really sweet deal after World War II, but particularly after the end of the Cold War, being kind of protected from a geopolitical point of view, from the United States, having access to all markets, not worrying much about geopolitics, and that Latin America's experience, historical experience of that order, was much more difficult. Also, because of the, despite some development success, it hasn't allowed these countries to really, you know, grow consistently. That was certainly an issue, I think.
So isn't there a danger, or let me put it this way, how big is the danger that at the moment when Latin America makes its appearance on the international stage, it pivots from being dependent on the US and Europe to being dependent on China?
Yeah, that's, as I said, that's particularly a concern given the systemic and deep-seated ignorance and lack of knowledge. And we've, as a university, we've tried to attract young, bright sinologists. But there's kind of a first mover issue when you try to set up a new academic field. Let's say you graduated from the University of some European university or US university, and you really speak fluent Chinese. You know, unless you have some personal reason to live in Brazil, you basically remove yourself from your community. So you immediately become the person to talk to about China, and the media will come to you. Anything that happens in Asia, you will have to comment on. I remember my PhD was a comparative study on Brazil and India. And as kind of an assistant professor, I got lots of requests from policymakers on China, and I always said, look, you know, I've been to China, but I have not never studied China. And they're like, but you've studied India, and this will somehow help you with your making.
Close enough.
And of course, now there's been some progress, but we still, again, unless there's some kind of incentive, we cannot produce the knowledge on these nations, in particular now that it's so difficult to be critical yet retain access to these places. So that's something that worries me a lot, actually, how that will work out.
But this is richly ironic, isn't it, that in a time with a strong post-colonial rhetoric and a strong effort to dismantle colonial structures, there is a Chinese neo-colonialist attitude that works through investments in infrastructure, investments in firms, that is in very important in Africa, in parts of Africa, and that is also, I believe, very important in South America.
Yes, even though I think there's been an emergence of a kind of Sino-phobic rhetoric in Africa, in parts because China's approach in Africa is different from what we see in Latin America, where, for example, there's no Chinese workers building ports and stadiums, which would be due to a very strong civil society in Latin America, would not be politically acceptable. And I think that in many ways, I think it's necessary also to recognize that China has been able to provide, through large infrastructure projects, something that Latin America desires, in which European countries or the United States are no longer offering. For example, I spoke to the German ambassador, and she said, look, the German companies, they want to build these very high-end products which you put on an oil rig, but they don't want to build the oil rig. That other countries should do that, because these large infrastructure projects like train line, there's a shopping mall in Buenos Aires called Pacifico, this was the place where the train to the Pacific was supposed to start. Now this is a century old and it was never finished, and there's no connection, for example, between Brazil and the Pacific, which of course due to its strong trade ties to China would be important. But there's no there's no European or American company saying, we will help you build a train from Sao Paulo to Chile, or, you know, large. So these are the things that China is currently offering, and they're highly attractive for Latin American governments and publics. Now, some of these are, of course, a bit shoddy, and there's a growing concern about the potential debt trap that this relationship could cause. And also, of course, the quality of the trade relation between Latin America and China is the worst you could imagine. It's actually, so Brazil has a trade surplus with China because it sells lots of commodities, but the terms of trade are bad because it buys value-added goods, but it just exports lots of commodities. So the terms of trade with Europe and the United States are actually less bad. They're still pretty bad, but they're less bad. What I think is unclear to me is what's sort of the United States proposition. How does it respond to the strong presence of Chinese, of Chinese companies? That's I think something that's missing, which explains the Chinese success. It's also Chinese engagement in the region is seen as less imposing and paternalistic, of course. So, at the height of the Amazon fires, the entire West was, furious with Bolsonaro. These Amazon fires happen every year, but Bolsonaro was a climate denialist, and he was almost like a cartoonish villain who said, oh, I don't believe in climate change. So it was an easy target for the entire West. And at the height of this, the Chinese, the number two of the Chinese embassy gave a big interview in the Brazilian media and said, we admire the way how Brazil manages its, Amazon forest. And it was a signal which said, we are all weather friends. So whatever you go through, we will be on your side, which is basically the what makes BRICS so attractive. Because once Bolsonaro was, basically isolated in the West, where was the only safe space where he could go without facing any critical questions? The BRICS summit. That was the same for Putin. Until now that South Africa decided to uninvite him to the BRICS summit because of the arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. This was also the safe space for Putin. So in a way, it became a life raft for these countries in case of isolation. But I think with time, there's also growing skepticism vis-a-vis the Chinese win-win narrative, which is kind of simplistic and has been utilized across the global south for a long time.
If you want to develop economically and perhaps also politically and have a seat at the table, then the big question is always, where does your energy come from? Where does the energy come from for this Latin American development?
You mean
the fossil energy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, and I want to combine that with the question you asked about Argentina, because I think it's on everybody's mind, sort of what's happening there. And I think the way to think about the rise of Bolsonaro and the rise of Milei is not only that these are little replicas of Donald Trump. They're also a reflection of the difficulties that sort of third wave democracies are encountering at providing basic public goods and of satisfying tremendous expectations and needs by populations which are frustrated by the limited capacity of political elites to provide these services like public security, basic access to health and education, combating inequality. So all this is also a signal of a much broader question about whether this transition to democracy has actually delivered the things that we were promised throughout the late 80s and early 90s. So I think that's that's also Malay, the fact that countries continue to elect people who question the basic tenets of democracy is in and itself a sign of the threat that these democracies are facing.
You're talking about third wave democracies, but we've got our own little crop of right-wing extremist leaders in Europe.
Yeah. And I can't really comment much on that because I don't follow European politics that much, of course. So it may be part also of a global phenomenon, but I think that the rise of somebody like Malay is just a signal that people, a lot of his voters say, I have got nothing to lose. There's no sense of how things could possibly improve for me, so I might just as well let this guy have a try, because it can't get any worse. And this is, a lot of the voters are sort of young men who have no memory of the dictatorship, because they cannot imagine how things could get any worse. And a lot of older voters say they can actually get much, much worse, which is why a lot of people are concerned about Milei. And I think this is where the energy issue comes in, because there's a fundamental importance, I think, of Latin America in the coming years, which is the energy transition. Latin America, I think there's three key issues to keep in mind. The first is that countries like Brazil have an incredibly clean energy matrix. So Brazil, the largest part of its energy it comes from renewables, and which is impossible for any, at this short term, for any large economy in the West to achieve. And which also explains the resistance to some of that imposing kind of an haughty Western language about how, Brazil should do more to combat climate change, etc., which sometimes ignores the fact that Brazil has a much cleaner energy matrix, and that also it's really difficult for a poor country to police the Amazon, which is the size of Western Europe, and which has law and order problems, which is organized crime, where you have 30 million people who need to live and who need to prosper economically. It's not just, you cannot save the Amazon by just sending the army and then repressing everybody. You must find sustainable development models for the 30 million people who live there. But Latin America is also becoming a key element of the global value chain in the production of, for example, batteries for electric vehicles. So it is the dominant. It has the dominant. The largest deposits of lithium in the world, Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, but also Brazil. A lot of rare earths. And what China's, of course, doing is to try to pull these countries into these value chains, which lead to the production of these batteries largely in China. But even if the energy transition takes more time, the largest discoveries of oil still unexplored are in Latin America, and in the over the next decade, starting in 2030, Latin America has the potential to produce more oil than Saudi Arabia. So even if, let's say,
hooray,
so countries like Brazil are now actually exceeding Venezuela, and even Guyana, a small Latin American country, has the capacity to become the country with the highest per capita income in the world if it manages its oil wealth, which could very much, of course, also go wrong.
That didn't go so fabulously well for Venezuela.
Yes.
That oil wealth question. But that brings me to another question. I was once in Bogota in Colombia, and I was shown around the wonderful great library there that the National Bank has built. And the director showed me around, and he talked about the political arrangements and talked about the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. And at one point I asked quite innocently, is there also a Social Democrat or Socialist Party in Colombia? And his answer was, why don't we go to my office? There we can talk with more quietly. And he took me to his office and he explained to me that during the 19th century there was a party of the landowners, the conservatives, and a party of the industrialists, the liberals, and they shared power. And whoever did not agree with them and was left of that basically had to go to the jungle and become a guerrillero. And that is how that country was set on its political path in the 20th century. I may be simplifying horribly here, but it made me understand how little as a European I understood about South American politics, that something I had simply taken for granted was not there. So what do we Europeans not understand about South America and its politics? Where are our blind spots? What do you observe?
Well, I think Latin America is a tremendous success case when it comes to establishing democracy in countries where that face so many profound challenges, and that these countries are capable of holding on to their democracies in a situation of tremendous economic volatility, in situations where the state is being challenged in a profound way, where organized crime, for example, is in control of parts of the territories, which, by the way, explains why Latin American countries, I think, are far more concerned about their sovereignty than meets the eye from a European perspective. Because, for example, Brazil has a massive problem in controlling its own borders. Any attempt Western attempts to put pressure on Brazil to do more, let's say, to combat deforestation, etc., immediately is being seen through this lens of that if we allow sort of groups from outside to take a larger role there, we may not be able to adequately control that. So I think we've seen now in Ecuador, a country which is neither a producer of cocaine nor a consumer, be profoundly battered by drug-related violence, has the highest amount of, has a huge spike of homicides, has a leading presidential contender be shot during the campaign because it's on the path of exporting drugs to the United States, Europe, and Asia. So I think that's, to my mind today, an underappreciated challenge to democracies in the region is how do these countries address the increasingly sophisticated transnational character of organized crime. So I think that's a first profoundly worrisome issue. But I think also that there's incredible innovation taking place. We see, for example, in Argentina, where grassroots movements have been able to push a predominantly Catholic and incredibly conservative country towards legalizing abortion in a way that no grassroots movement in the United States has achieved. And there were lots of US activists are coming to Argentina to learn of this is not like in the United States where the Supreme Court decision can simply change the law of the land, but this has been passed by Congress because it was capable of mobilizing society. And I think in many other ways, the debates about what can be done to increase the, let's say, the representation of indigenous populations, of black people, of women. There's, for example, in numerous countries in Latin America, there's a 50% gender quota in parliament. Now, I'm not saying that this is the way, Europeans should do it or anything, but there's incredible laboratories of how to consolidate democracy. There's hugely vibrant debates in these countries about how to address some of the very urgent challenges these countries face. And I think many times that gets a bit lost by these figures like Malay, which of course are very flamboyant. But I would say, for example, in the case of Argentina, I'm quite confident that the institutions can sufficiently restrain the president-elect, who for now at least I think doesn't pose yet sort of a mortal threat to democracy. And in a way, I think Brazil, for example, has dealt much better with somebody like Bolsonaro than the United States has dealt with Trump. Bolsonaro was voted out of office. It was a bit we had political violence, but the electoral courts made Bolsonaro ineligible for 8 years, which is why we most probably won't have him run for office again like Trump does now in the United States. So I think in this, there's a profoundly positive element to how things are going as well, which I think deserve more visibility. And I've told you before, I'm more optimistic today about Latin America than at any stage over the past decade.
But that's really fascinating. I mean, you said in a conversation we had before tonight that Don't forget, a country like Brazil or Colombia doesn't actually control all its own territory. Indeed, even in big cities, it doesn't control all of the city. Now, Misha Glenny is here, and he's written a book partly about one of the people who takes over the control, namely someone in a favela who is, well, to the eyes of many, a criminal, but to them he was their leading politician, who also kept the peace and the order in the land. There is an incredible resilience to this culture and these cultures. When you come to Europe and you see our tired democracies, which seem a bit clapped out, and the general feeling of disorientation that you find in many European countries about what now, how, where do we go now, what are our great systems that no longer seem to work so well, that produce aberrant politicians, that produce funny parties, that what do you think Europe could learn from Latin America and its resilient approach to democracy?
Well, I think it's always a bit preposterous to say, look, this is how we're doing things, why don't you try this out? So I'm very wary of...
Europe has been very good at that, yes. So...
But I think, as I said, I think the there's been, particularly when comparing this to progressive and liberal reform in the United States, I think there's been a tremendous progress in many countries of, for example, renovating politics. So the president of Chile is a genuine modern left. And I think Latin America's left has been unable to renew itself. And I think that this was a student leader who rose to fame as part of protests of university students. And he, at a very young age, I think, has become a very mature leader who's rose to the presidency. Of course, also because the established parties were discredited. But who I think is somebody who deserves a lot of attention and who's been able to, I think, sort of take Chile in a way to take the conversation to the next level. He's facing tremendous difficulties, but the way in which Chile has, for example, dealt with discussing ways to find a new, to craft a new constitution. Now, they failed at the first time, they will probably fail at the second time, but it's an incredibly inclusive process of how to think about what kind of country do we want to be. I think that's a terrific case study of how it is possible to discuss these things in an organized and inclusive manner. And as I said, I think Argentine civil society will be crucial also to resist the anti-democratic impulse that will emanate from the president-elect. I think it's mostly these aspects that I think deserve attention. Now, I really don't know if there's much that, say, the Europeans can say, let's adopt the Latin American model. But also because democracy continues to be under continuous threat. And one of the issues I think that's of particular concern is how polarization makes an organized debate increasingly more difficult. I find it always worrisome when I ask scholars of Latin American politics, and I say, "Are you on TikTok?" And they say, "Oh no, I don't like TikTok. I don't watch these dance videos." Whereas TikTok has long emerged as the most powerful political platform that shapes the way how young voters, whom they vote for. And I think the new social media. Functions according to very different principles than, let's say, Facebook, which is something that young people say, this is what my grandmother uses, Facebook. And even Instagram is what my parents use. I don't use Instagram. It's TikTok. And what TikTok does is there's an algorithm which understands very, very much what you like and what you don't like. You don't actually follow specific individuals, but you are suggested content which tends to be exactly what you believe in. So it reinforces your beliefs and makes you less capable and less tolerant of considering other people's points of view. So the more you spend on TikTok, the more you're in your bubble, and you believe that that's anything outside of that bubble is crazy extremism. And I think in this particular regard, Europe and Latin America have so many shared challenges. Is how do you regulate, how do you govern the internet without limiting free speech? And this is something where, you know, countries like China or Russia they cannot participate in these debates. And I feel like those are the issues that can be looked at jointly. And we've had a fascinating experience with this. One of my colleagues at the university, at the height of the election, right after the election, he made a very stupid comment on Twitter, and he said, "It's so strange that some districts in Brazil, nobody voted for Bolsonaro," which were indigenous districts. Now, that's quite understandable because Bolsonaro has done everything to decimate the indigenous population. But he said that in a way that gave more credence to false claims by Bolsonaro to say that the elections were rigged. And the Supreme Court of Brazil blocked my colleague immediately from Twitter, because the Supreme Court said that fake news spreads so fast that we must monocratically, one Supreme Court judge signs an order, and immediately Twitter blocks the account, because this was, in the mind of the Supreme Court judge, would be used by pro-Bolsonaro supporters to say, okay, this is a university professor who clearly is in agreement with our argument that the elections were rigged. So this was a very tense moment, because, and we're now at a stage where fake news, even if they're banned 2 hours later, the damage has been done, because this has spread like wildfire, and this spreads so quickly that this is no longer your old Facebook or an article that needs to be retracted. This is a question of seconds or minutes. And I think this is sort of the forefront of the major challenges democracy is facing.
There's another challenge, surely for a global standing of Southern American powers, which is the fact that they're not leading in any digital technologies, and that that has become a real key also for holding political power, which is very often information power in the world. This is a European problem also, that there's very little leading European digital technology. But if you're between the US and China, then where does the Latin American future stand in that regard? Just rare earths are just, again, commodities that are exported.
So in one particular aspect, I think, if I had to tell you two good news about Latin America's economy, I would of course talk about rare earths and sustainability and all that, but I'll also talk about, for example, fintech. There's amazing examples of financial inclusion, of how banks have been able to increase the number of poor people who have access now to digital banking. So there's been lots of innovation there, in part because the banks were so much behind that newcomers could actually capture large market shares, like Nubank, for example, which is a Colombian bank, which is now one of the largest banks in Latin America, which was founded a few years ago only. So in this area, I think, or we have a Latin American version of Amazon, which is called Mercado Libre, which is an Argentine company, and which is actually much, much more competitive than Amazon, which sends you things on the next day, whereas Mercado Libre literally sends you things in 3 hours.
Before you ordered them.
Exactly, yes. Exactly, before you ordered them. So it's quite amazing, actually. So there's some interesting stories there. I think very exciting things for investment funds, etc. But the technology issue is interesting because it's also tied to democracy, to privacy. And the United States has, and this is not only true for Latin America, but across the Global South, has put a lot of pressure on developing countries to stay away from Huawei. And this was, I think, one of
the Chinese
provider
internet company,
of components, yes, for telecoms networks. Not only 5G, so Huawei has been present in Brazil for 2G, 3G, 4G, all of these. And that was, I think, a profoundly counterproductive argument, because the way that developing countries understood this was, you don't want us to utilize this cheap Chinese technology which will help us because of your political concerns. And it was particularly interesting in Brazil, because all the Americans, particularly under Trump, talked about is, be careful with Huawei and you shouldn't use Huawei. But there had been just a few years ago this massive NSA spying scandal, which revealed that the US government had spied on Petrobras, Brazil's oil company, and even Dilma Rousseff, who's now head of the BRICS Development Bank in Shanghai. So there was a bit of that in saying, we will be spied on anyways. What's the difference between the United States and China? Which I'm not endorsing that argument. But the other issue was also, we need to develop, we cannot have the luxury to discuss this very abstract concern about privacy, which will maybe haunt us 10 years from now, but we need now access to this technology to be able to catch up with other countries where 5G technology is already quite developed. So it was a tremendous failure, the US pressure on Brazil to say, you'll have to choose. Now the compromise, and this was quite interesting, Bolsonaro was at the time in office and he was profoundly pro-Trump. And Trump said, if you want to become my partner, you need to ban Huawei, because if you utilize Huawei, we will no longer share information with you as a major non-NATO ally. We cannot share information because we cannot trust that you can keep secrets, because the Chinese may spy on you. So the Brazilians said, okay, let's produce a compromise. We'll have two 5G networks, one for the public and one for government officials, and that one will not have 5G technology, which is, you know, made both China and the United States unhappy. But which allowed, for now at least, the United States to continue to share sensitive information with Brazil. But it points to something quite important, I think, which is there is not yet an appreciation across the global south of how to address the deepening tensions between China and the United States. Because it's not only China that is important in countries like Brazil. Actually, the United States is still a more important investor in Brazil than China. And if you take the EU altogether, it's also bigger than China. So it's not like Brazil will want to side with China, but it also certainly doesn't want to side with the West, because there's this perception that any kind of static alliance will make it less comfortable for us. And we basically want to be non-aligned. We want to keep our flexibility. And there's I think, not yet an appreciation how the emergence of, let's say, the digital Iron Curtain, which we're already seeing in a way, right? So there's no tech company, or very few American tech companies in the Chinese market. Increasingly, I think there will be the life of the likes of TikTok will be more difficult in the United States. And where does that leave countries that have no interest in that battle? I think that's something that Brazil is only beginning to discuss. So how does it respond to the global tech war? And I think there's still a belief, or perhaps an illusion, that for decades to come, Brazil can be friends with everyone, even though those friends are amongst them increasingly in a sort of a geopolitical competition. And I think that's perhaps the biggest challenge of how will it react to that, and how will it react to pressure from great powers to side with them on such matters like technology.
So, just to finish this conversation before we take one or two questions from the audience, but you're talking about the next decades. Take us forward 10 or 20 years, and there is a resurgent global south that is demanding more say in the security architecture of the world and the economic architecture in the world. Where do you think could that go in a positive way, and where do you think it will be more likely to go in 10 or 20 years?
I actually, and I've defended this before, I think the transition to multipolarity is a fundamentally positive development, because it provides a larger amount of countries a say. And I mean, objectively speaking, a world led by the G7 is, and I'm not even sort of, this is not an anti-Western statement, but it is a historical aberration, of course, because the world, demographically speaking, is not West led by the West. So in a way, it's a positive development that Asia is on the rise again, because that means that per capita GDP in places like Asia and developing countries is increasing. It's in a way the pandemic has of course changed these dynamics, but let's say the rise of the rest is above all a positive development. It's something to be celebrated in a way. And I always think that the friction produced by the likes of India and Brazil to want to have a seat at the table of the powerful is a unique opportunity to reach out and say, great, what are the public goods that Brazil would like to offer to the world? And I think in many ways Brazil has begun to say that. Haiti is a great example. In 2004, Haiti was yet again in a state of anarchy, and Brazil led the UN peacekeeping mission to try to stabilize Haiti. It was a tragic failure. The UN, this was not Brazilian sources, but the UN imported cholera into Haiti, lots of people died. But it was a unique moment because Brazil led a global effort to try to solve a problem which the international community had to solve. Haiti was not going to fix itself. And now, it's interesting, 20 years later, Haiti again is in a state of anarchy. Not a single Latin American country said, I'll lead this. Why? And this is quite interesting. Why didn't Brazil want to send soldiers to Haiti? Because the relationship after the, let's face it, attempted coup, which, let's say, euphemistically at least, had the tacit support of part of Brazil's armed forces, that relationship is still so tense, the civil-military relations, that Lula doesn't have the trust to send a large contingent of soldiers to Haiti, because that may produce dynamics he cannot control, and because he currently needs the armed forces to quell violence within Brazil. So the armed forces are currently protecting the airport of Rio, the ports of Rio, because of organized crime, which is producing a lot of instability. Now, that shows that, you know, if Brazil wants to be at the table, then it must be engaged on, you know, how can it actually specifically, you know, provide global public goods. And I think this is important because if the West would like to continue leading in this provision of global public goods, then we're in a terrible situation because it won't be able to do that. It's necessary, and this is why in the Middle East, I think it's positive to have Qatar and, you know, China step up, because the United States, further 10 years down the line, will not be able to solve all these crises. So in a way, it's a positive development. And I think we must think about reform of the international institutions more seriously. I personally find it very tiresome for Brazil. Wherever the president goes, he will talk about UN Security Council reform, which will just not happen. And that's not the West's fault, but it's just too difficult to achieve. But the IMF has never been led by non-European, and that's certainly an issue in today's world. It's just no longer, it's just anachronistic. And the fact that the United States continues to appoint the head of the World Bank is anachronistic. Now, in the past, I think BRICS countries could have produced like the BRICS candidate, and it was quite interesting that Mexico launched a candidate to, this was Carstens actually, when Dominique Strauss-Kahn was ousted from the IMF, the Mexicans said, you know, we need somebody from the global south to head the IMF. We have the economist who's very qualified. But Brazil said, no, okay, we don't want a Mexican. If we have a Latin America, we'll certainly be from Brazil. So there was no consensus among the global south. I think it was a nice example to show that as these countries seek greater responsibilities, they will also face the dilemmas of what that actually means, and the fact that there is no leader of the global south. The term global south is kind of a huge, it doesn't really describe much other than the non-West. And that, you know, Brazil's ambition to quote unquote lead in the global south does produce a lot of resistance amongst a lot of its neighbors. And Brazil certainly doesn't accept India to lead the global south, doesn't accept China to lead the global south. And very few countries say, I want Brazil to lead because it represents me. So I think these are important discussions to be had. And if we can, you know, re-energize the G20, make institutions like the World Bank and the IMF more representative, or think about new institutions like a World Data Organization. And you know, I think there's lots of opportunity for productive engagement of these actors.
Just before you begin, before I ask for questions from the audience, because you mentioned it several times, is the greatest enemy of the development of these countries, the continuing development, not from the outside, but is it organized crime?
In Latin America, I think today I would say that yes, organized crime is one of the key challenges to democracy, certainly. I would still say that inequality and poverty continue to be the main challenges. It's very difficult to preserve democracy if you're unable to provide basic goods to parts of the population. So half of Brazil's population doesn't have access to treated sewage, for example. So when you talk about protecting the Amazon, and that's why I think it's always so important, is to say, why doesn't Brazil do more to protect the Amazon? Well, first of all, as I said, it's the size of Western Europe. It's extremely difficult to do that. But there's so many immediate challenges, that domestic challenges that these countries, like and many others, are facing, that it's not on the top of the list, neither of policymakers nor of voters, actually. So I think poverty and inequality continue to be major threats. But I also think it's time to realize that Latin America will increasingly face challenges to its democracy because, and I interviewed a former Paraguayan president a few years ago, and I said, what has changed from the 90s to the 2010s in Latin American politics? And he said, back in the 90s, the narcos would pay our campaigns, support our campaigns. Now they run for they run themselves, and they sit in parliament. And I think that is a profound concern. And let's say, of the sectors that have prospered mostly during the pandemic in Latin America, the region which was most affected in the entire world was organized crime, because the major institution to push back against recruitment of young people are schools. And if you close the schools, and they were closed in Latin America for longer than anywhere else in the world, then these children are incredibly vulnerable to being recruited by organized crime. And this is precisely what happened. And this is something that I think requires a regional or even global approach. And I think we're still in a situation where saying, as a US policymaker, let's bomb cartels in Mexico. Of course, it's a crazy idea, and most people would agree with that. But there's still a dominant perception that if we suppress supply, we can somehow solve this. I think that underestimates the complexity, the degree to which these institutions are beginning to undermine societies across Latin America.
Also seems to underestimate how markets work. But we have a few questions. I would ask you all, keep it short and sweet, please, your questions. There's two gentlemen over there. If you wait until the microphone comes to you.
Hello, very short. What did Brazil gain from enlargement of BRICS? And how will Brazil gain a bigger role in the world when its society is dysfunctional? Public service is broken, violence everywhere, and so on.
Well, so I think BRICS expansion was a bad deal for Brazil, because BRICS, above all, was a highly exclusive institution that provided prestige on the global stage. And one of the really fascinating things I think that shows that is that Brazil is still often referred to as an emerging power. And it is, in a way that it is, it aims to have more space. But if you look at the economics of it, it's actually, it's been flatlining for quite some time. So right now, if you just look at the economic data, it's really not sort of catching up quickly. And it's, for me, sort of in the short term, I think we're nowhere near to achieving sort of India or, let's say, Vietnam type rates of economic growth. Because of numerous structural challenges involving infrastructure and, as you point to, you know, violence, etc. So I think BRICS expansion largely served the Chinese interest of transforming BRICS into a part of a Sino-centric world order, which as a major power, I think is a natural thing to do. If you're a major power, you want institutions to solidify and sort of consolidate your position as a center. And I think BRICS is becoming that. Brazil was against BRICS expansion, and it actually specifically requested prior to the South Africa summit that if there's expansion, please don't include anti-Western countries. And the fact that China insisted on including Iran, I think is a sign of how China is now less concerned about being perceived as a dominant force within BRICS. So this whole narrative of a club of five countries seeing eye to eye is, you know, that has been cast aside. I think BRICS will be fascinating to see. The next BRICS summit will take place in Kazan in Russia. The Brazilian diplomats are concerned that Putin may invite the leaders of Belarus and Syria. And in that case, of course, it will be difficult for Brazil to block the anti-Western language. I was part of a debate in Moscow in 2015 where Vyacheslav Molotov, who was the head of the BRICS think tank delegation, he said, we must finally embrace the anti-Western nature of BRICS. And the Brazilian head of the delegation raised his hand and said, we are also part of the West to some extent, which I thought was quite interesting, sort of we're at the edges of the West, we will not embrace anti-Western language. And this is why I think from a European or US perspective, it's important to have Brazil in the BRICS. Now, the democracies in BRICS are now the minority. And to me personally, I think it's quite a disappointment that Argentina, which would have been an important member to the BRICS community as a democracy, will probably now not join because Milei has promised already that he will oppose or he will decline the invitation to BRICS. I think BRICS will become less capable of finding any kind of consensus. I like to joke that if you have a problem of falling asleep, then you should just pull up a BRICS declaration, and you after a couple of paragraphs, you will drowse, because it's so difficult of all these countries to find consensus. But some of it is relevant. Between the lines, you can sort of sense there is some relevance, and this is, I think, important. What, at least from the founding members, was important, that all these countries believed that they had something unique to contribute on the global stage. And this is a profound conviction in Brazil, that Brazil is important not because of what it does, but of what it is. And I think that somehow, at least underappreciated outside of Brazil, belittled, and you don't have to agree with it, but that's, I think, some of the glue that make BRICS so important. Now, vis-a-vis, you say Brazil is a dysfunctional society. Yes, I don't know, of course, are there any functional societies left? I mean, that's sort of the question. What I think is that the way that Brazil has, the last 30 years of Brazil, the last decade of Brazil has been very frustrating, and things have, you know, economic growth has flatlined, we've seen the emergence of anti-democratic forces, but it's still above all a good story. I mean, it's still a country that where democracy doesn't, you know, come natural in a way that the fact that we're still democratic after 10 years of economic stagnation in a country where there's so much poverty and so much inequality is really quite something. And the fact how the country has been able to oppose anti-democratic forces in a peaceful way, and we got rid of a president with authoritarian ambitions in a peaceful, largely peaceful way, is, I think, something that should be celebrated. Now, I completely agree with you. We have unacceptable levels of violence, unacceptable levels of inequality, but the only way to address them will be through democratic means. Because a lot of these challenges emerge from the non-democratic period. Older friends from Brazil say, back in the 70s, public education was much better. And it was much better. But that was because thousands and thousands of children didn't go to school. And now they do go to school. And that, of course, initially led to a decline in quality, but it's much more inclusive now. Brazil has the largest freely accessible public health system in the world. And it's really an amazing phenomenon. And we sometimes have delegations over and somebody, you know, has a heat stroke or something and we take them to the hospital and they're treated for free. And nobody asks them for their passport or nationality or nothing. And people are quite amazed and say, wow, I mean, if you have a heart attack, you still want to go to a private hospital. But the fact that there is, in principle, that is, I think, a profoundly democratic and an admirable institution. So I think Brazil has made significant steps. That's what we call sort of modernizing and civilizing reforms, the largest cash transfer program in the world, the largest free healthcare system. And again, a capacity to at least attempt to address some of these structural challenges in a peaceful way provides me with some hope, but I don't want to minimize the problems that you mentioned, and we shouldn't try to hide them. They're very present and very worrisome.
There's another question from a gentleman here.
Hello to everyone. My name is Milan Gajic. I'm a master's student at the Diplomatic Academy of Vienna. Recently, I attended an event discussing India positioning in the emerging new global order. It was emphasized that India no longer wishes to follow the rules set by the West, but rather desires to expand its global influence and actively shape future new order. Similar aspirations are held by China, and if victorious in conflict, Russia will likely pursue the same agenda. Therefore, we'll witness many states aiming not only to participate in, but to actively shape the world order, including the US, China, India, Russia, and even the EU. Do you think Brazil also seeks to shape this new global order? Or is it satisfied with a stronger position than before? Furthermore, do you believe such a scenario might lead to general chaos and potentially cause a new war?
I absolutely think that Brazil would like to have play a more significant role. And if you look at, not only from this government, but for example, Brazil has, in 2010, there was a fascinating case where Brazil sought to negotiate a nuclear deal with Erdogan from Turkey, who was then prime minister, and Ahmadinejad from Iran. And the reasoning behind it was quite interesting, because from a Brazilian point of view, the Middle East was seen as the grail of sort of, if you engage in the Middle East, that means you're a great power. So if you have real ambition, you need to tackle the really tricky issues, and Brazil has a role to play. Now, that is a belief that I think is deeply culturally rooted in Brazil, and you only have that, as I said, in India, in China, in Russia, in the United States, and perhaps a bit, I don't know, in the UK or France, where there's just the basic proposition of the way you look at the world is that we should play a key role, and that's unquestioned. And that, of course, makes Brazil want to engage on tricky issues, and that makes it sort of a natural reaction, which at times causes incredible friction. And I disagree with what Lula has said about the war in Ukraine, but the natural reaction by the president was, let's see if Brazil can somehow mediate between Russia and Ukraine. And that, of course, causes friction. Now, I think the fact that Brazil wants to engage is not necessarily, is not likely to cause chaos, because, see, Brazil doesn't want to, if Brazil had a revolutionary agenda, it would say, let's get rid of the UN Security Council, and now the UN General Assembly should decide everything. It doesn't want that. It wants to be part of that elite. It wants reform of these institutions, part of that. But it doesn't want to do away with the UN. It doesn't want to do away with international law. And when there's this criticism of the West of saying you apply the law selectively, Brazil isn't against the rules and norms. It's actually, it just wants to, Brazil believes, and India does as well, that some of these rules aren't being applied universally. That doesn't mean that these countries have the moral high ground. I think, as I said, in the case of Ukraine, the West had the better argument. It was the opposition or the reluctance to side with Ukraine more decisively, I think, was highly controversial from countries across the global South. But I think there's a division between, let's say, India, Brazil, Mexico, Colombia. South Africa is a bit in the middle, but let's say these countries are genuinely believe that their participation can strengthen international decision-making processes, international law, etc. Whereas, let's say, countries like Russia have a more deeply revisionist sort of stance that I think it's harder to argue that Russia is actively seeking to sort of strengthen rules and norms. So I think there's a bit of a division in the Global South, and that has been a point of tension within BRICS between countries that they want to reform the international system, but they don't want to rock the boat too much. They want to be part of that, of these decision-making processes. So I think I am not too pessimistic. In that way, I agree with the official Brazilian position. I think that the return to multipolarity is inevitable, and we have to just make the best of it. And I think, of all things considered, the likes of Brazil and India are certainly, or at least have the potential to engage more constructively than some others. So I think there's no desire to sort of undermine the way the UN works, but gain greater space as decisions are being made.
Oliver, thank you very much. Thank you all for being a wonderful audience and for asking excellent questions. And most of all, I'm thanking Oliver Stünkel for being our guest tonight. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Oliver.